I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Last week, former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger was convicted and sentenced to 10 years for the murder of Botham Jean. Geiger entered Jean's apartment last year and shot and killed him, allegedly mistaking his apartment for her own. After the conviction, a striking scene unfolded in the courtroom when Jean's brother Brandt read his victim impact statement.
I'm not going to say anything else. I think giving your life to Christ would be the best thing that both of them would want you to do. Again, I love you as a person. And I don't wish anything bad on you. I don't know if this is possible, but can I give her a hug, please? Please?
Yes.
Then later, the judge who oversaw the case, a black woman named Tammy Kemp, also hugged Geiger and handed her a Bible. These displays of empathy have sparked a robust debate about the expectations of black Americans in the aftermath of violence and injustice. Many have weighed in, including Bernice King, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter, saying that racism and white supremacy cannot be, quote, hugged out. We're joined now by three guests to talk about this and why it struck a chord with so many. Dr. Jen M. Jackson is an assistant professor of political science at Syracuse University who focuses on black politics, gender, and sexuality, and a columnist at Teen Vogue. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're also joined by Aaron Haynes, the Associated Press's national writer on race and ethnicity. Aaron, always great to have you on.
Good to be back with you.
And we also have Clint Smith. He's a PhD candidate at Harvard University and author of the forthcoming book, How the Word is Passed. Welcome back, Clint.
I appreciate it.
Aaron, let's start with you. One of the key witnesses in this case was killed last week. How is the community responding to that?
Well, we are still learning about that. Joshua Brown, who was the neighbor of Botham Jean, who testified during this trial, was killed over the weekend, and that case is still being investigated. Not sure if his killing was related to his testimony, but certainly that is a suspicion among many, particularly in the activist community. You know, they are seeing this as more than a coincidence, but authorities have not necessarily said that that is the case.
Clint, I want to talk about the outcome here in this case. Geiger was sentenced for 10 years, which some are saying was just too lenient of a sentence. And this has raised questions about how much time should someone do. Your thoughts on the idea that that sentence was too lenient?
No, I certainly understand the impulse of people, given the context of the case. What's important is to hold a couple of complicated truths together at once in this instance, and that allowing it to be complicated rather than cut and dry. So, for example, it is important to realize that had this woman not been both white and an agent of the state, that her sentence likely would have been longer. It is also important to note that there are black and brown and poor people in prison and jail right now for far longer, for doing far less harm. And it is important, I think, to recognize that 10 years is still a significant amount of time to be in prison. I think part of what has happened is that we have become so acculturated into believing that it is okay and that it should be expected that people are sentenced to life in prison, when actually we are very much an outlier historically and in the sort of contemporary world with regard to how long we sentence people to spend certain amounts of time in prison. Like, our sentences are particularly insidious and draconian, more so than anywhere else in the world. And so, as somebody who studies prisons, as somebody who works in prisons, I know that prisons are terrible, violent places, and we should be doing all we can to ensure that we are moving toward decarceration and making prisons increasingly irrelevant by creating the systems and structures and social services that put people's lives on fundamentally different trajectories. But it also is understandable, I think, for people to feel aggrieved and to feel that there is injustice. But I think part of what we should want is not for justice to be zero sum.
One of the things that stood out here in this case was that the jury itself was perhaps more diverse in terms of its racial demographics than other juries have tended to be. I want to play a clip from an interview with two of the jurors who took part in this case. This is from an interview broadcast on Good Morning America last Friday. And this might help us understand a little bit more about why, at least in this one juror's opinion, they sentenced Geiger to 10 years.
He was kind and just
forgiving.
Caring and forgiving. And I told everyone, I was like, I'm really having a hard time with this because we all agree that it was a mistake. And I don't think Bo would want to take harsh vengeance. I think he would want to forgive her. I didn't feel like I had any right to speak for him. And he isn't there to talk for himself. But listening to how people talked about him, I felt like he would forgive her.
Jen, what do you make of what that juror just said?
So I think it's a really complex conversation, right? When we hear the jurors talking about Botham John, we have to understand this is an extremely religious family, right? We have to root this conversation in knowing that this is an orientation that roots this family's identity when it comes to empathy and forgiveness. However, I think when we think about what's also happening, I can't help but remember when there was this idea that somehow Michael Brown was not the best victim, right? That Michael Brown was no angel. And so when we think about a Botham John versus a Michael Brown, I think that's kind of what we see coming up here. And I want to draw attention to that because part of what I think is also happening is that we have this ongoing conversation about what it means for Black Americans across the spectrum, across identity markers of race, gender, sexual orientation, embodiment, being judged and deemed the right type or the wrong type of victims. And sometimes that affects the types of justice that is adjudicated because of those judgments and how those are made and how those come down. So I think what ends up happening in this instance, while we have people who are looking at these stories about forgiveness, we have to also think about the fact that there are biases, there are propensities that are triggering responses to the ways that people are making judgments about who Botham John was and who this family is and what they may have wanted and what he may have wanted. And those things are happening in kind of a tug of war. They're happening and putting pressures on the ways that this entire process is being judged because there's a history of anti-Black racism and a long-rooted systemic orientation toward anti-Blackness in our criminal judicial system. We know that the victim is often, even if they are not there, they are going to be judged. And the outcomes of those cases will often rest on how the victims are deemed in the court as well.
Aaron, I want to ask you about you've written about the responsibility that is placed on Black people to forgive, especially in the aftermath of violence and tragedy. Where does this idea originate in your reporting?
Well, you know, the folks that I spoke to, just to kind of piggyback on what Clint said a bit, I mean, there is a relationship between, I mean, certainly forgiveness as a Christian tenet is something that is present. But for Black folks, the relationship between race and faith and forgiveness are definitely tied together. And a lot of folks, in seeing the gesture by Brant John and then by the judge that was translated into this larger conversation about public forgiveness instead of the personal choices, they were reminded of the Charleston 9 shooting and the response of some of the families there to immediately say that they forgave Dylan Roof. And I actually talked in my reporting to the Reverend Sharon Risher, whose mother, Ethel Lee Lance, was one of the Charleston 9 who was slain in that attack. She was actually not among those who immediately forgave Dylan Roof. Her sister did say that she forgave him. And what she said is that, you know, it just always seems like Black people are given that heavy task of being able to forgive. It's almost like a generational DNA strand that we have as Black people, even going back to slavery. And really, kind of the unspoken message is that Black anger is unchristian, right? That we should be nonviolent and calm in the face of violence that is done to us and to our communities. And that's kind of a racial theater that we've seen play out over and over again throughout our history. You know, when somebody's personal choice to forgive is kind of taken on by the larger public and saying, you know, well, if he can forgive, you know, shouldn't we all be more forgiving? You know, what that does is really, you know, that sinners Amber Geiger instead of Botham John, who was the victim here, and makes forgiveness really more about moving on than about the healing that gesture is intended to provide, again, not for the public, but for that individual who is doing the act of forgiving.
And to that point, Jen, I want to talk a little, because you mentioned the phrase tug of war earlier, and I'm thinking this burden of feeling that one has to express forgiveness, one has to express empathy, and yet the anger that often Black communities and Black people, American Black people, are not allowed to exhibit, and this idea of having to comfort those who have done things that are in the name of oppression, that are in the name of racism. And so is that the tug of war that we're trying to unpack here, Jen?
When we were all talking just a moment ago, I wanted to think about respectability politics, right? I wanted to think about specifically the public performance of forgiveness as a mode of survival. So Roxane Gay has written about this. Jemele Hill's written about this. Some of us have also written about this. But the expectation that Black Americans should forgive in order to sometimes suppress additional emotive responses from certain communities, or to sometimes quell fears that there may be additional violence between groups, right? There's often this expectation that Black Americans who have been harmed should perform, and I say perform very deliberately, for forgiveness for parties who have harmed them, specifically because it does become a stand-in for absolution, right? And I'm not saying that it is one, but I'm saying that it's often read that way, in ways that can be very detrimental.
And you mentioned performative justice and solidarity, Jen and Clint. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. We talked about, last time you were on the show, we talked about the 1619 Project at the New York Times and sort of the reframing of history and the history of slavery in this country. And one of the things that comes up in that conversation is how the United States, as a state, has not performed its performative justice, if you will, in any form to Black Americans, to the African American community in particular, for its role in slavery, whether that's through economic reparations or a formal apology. So at what point does this burden become even broader, where the state itself has refused in many ways to acknowledge both historically and economically the role that chattel slavery played in this country, and yet Black Americans still feel an onus on themselves to have to continue to do this performative justice?
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think that Jen made some really important points. And just to build on that quickly, I think, you know, what happens when forgiveness is not only used to mitigate the guilt, the sort of collective guilt and the interpersonal guilt that Geiger might feel or that the public might feel, but also when it is co-opted, and as it was, I feel like, with so many people, but particularly the Dallas Police Department, who put out a statement sort of using Botham John's brother's hug and expression of forgiveness as a means of attempting to move forward without reckoning with the sort of accountability that they have in what happened. And I think that Botham John's mother had a really powerful statement that didn't get as much attention as the hug.
That 10 years in prison is 10 years for her reflection and for her to change her life. But there is much more to be done by the city of Dallas. The corruption that we saw during this process must stop.
Amen.
And it must stop for you.
Amen.
Because after now, I leave Dallas, but you live in Dallas. And it must stop for everyone.
It's interesting to think about which sentiments are lifted up, and the way that the performance, as Jen talked about, of forgiveness was lifted up from Brant John, but from the sort of the very real concerns brought up by Botham John's mother did not get nearly the same amount of coverage, because they speak to something that is more of an indictment of the Dallas Police Department and of our sort of larger culture around policing. And as you mentioned, the how all of this is entangled in a sort of larger history in which we are unable and have been unable for the last 400 years to grapple with how slavery has shaped every facet of American political, social, cultural, and economic life, and that the residue of such still shapes the sort of landscape of inequality that we see today and how different groups of people are treated at the hands of the state.
Clint is exactly right on that point. I mean, it really is exactly what he was saying, just the prioritizing of the forgiveness piece over Black anger or Black anguish. Black anger is not justified or acknowledged. You know, when you see that, you know, what a lot of the folks that I interviewed would say that it's a denial of Black folks' humanity to remove from Black people the agency of their anger, to say that, you know, it's unchristian for them to display that anger. It just doesn't allow them to be human, and you just don't always see similar calls for grace or compassion from white Americans who are victims of violence or who have lost a loved one. And so, we just don't ever really analyze white anger as being irrational or unjustified. And there's just never a policing of how white people are going to respond in a moment, as opposed to when these types of incidents happen in the Black community. Like, the question is always, you know, well, what are Black people going to do? Are they going to respond with violence, even though the violence was committed, you know, against that Black community?
Also, just to wrap up here, Jen, how do you think these expectations for Black Americans are changing, particularly when it comes to younger Black Americans today?
So my research, talking to young Black folks on the South Side of Chicago, and to Aaron's point, thinking specifically about what it means when young Black Americans are harmed and they recognize the harm and they feel anguish about that harm. What I've had young people tell me is that they feel that they are not allowed to actually express the fullness of human emotion, that they are not allowed, for instance, to go in public and express anger. And so what I'm finding is maybe not that the expectations of young Black Americans or Black communities are changing, but that for a lot of young Black Americans who I've talked to, they're just saying, you know, we are not going to allow these expectations to shape and dictate how we choose to move through the world and how we choose to address those in power for a redress of grievances. And while the expectations, I think, have remained relatively rigid, what's happening, at least in my research, is that young people have been organizing for a great deal of time. And what they've been saying is that, you know, enough is enough.
Dr. Jen M. Jackson is an assistant professor of political science at Syracuse University and a columnist at Teen Vogue. Aaron Haynes is a reporter on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. And Clint Smith is a writer, teacher, and doctoral candidate at Harvard University and author of the forthcoming book, How the Word is Passed. Thanks to you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.